Happy Monday, everyone. Today, as many of you are doing, we're going to concentrate on the great outdoors. And that means we're talking about picking some apples, pumpkins, squash, and then later on, we're going to be talking honey and bees. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. If you have the day off, I hope you're enjoying it. Now, for many, with the kids home from school, it's almost a tradition to head to one of the farms in our region and do what else? Some apple picking, pumpkin picking, get a squash or two, and maybe grab a donut and some hot cider along the way. And that's what we're going to start with today. We're going to be talking about this right through our show, and we're going to start with Greg Sandor. Greg is the executive director of the Cornell Cooperative Extension, Nassau County. How are you, Greg? Thanks for coming on.
Great. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
For those who don't know, tell us about Cornell Cooperative Extension. What do you do?
Yeah, so we are kind of, as our name says, we're an extension of Cornell University. We have an office in every county in New York State. And the main mission is to take the research and education from Cornell University and put it to use hands-on in our different communities across New York State. So we are based here in Nassau County, and there's also a Suffolk County Cooperative Extension here on Long Island. As you can imagine, we're very involved in local agriculture and farming and promoting farm-to-table and helping folks figure out where their local food comes from.
And how many farms do you assist or work with in Nassau County?
In Nassau, the farms have dwindled. We used to be one of the largest agricultural regions in the state, and now there's probably, I think, somewhere around 10 or fewer larger farms. And then, obviously, there's a trend towards some of these urban farms, so there's a lot of small-scale farms popping up in Nassau. We run a small 3-acre demonstration farm in East Meadow, but there's all sorts of small businesses, growing things more like gardens than farms. Mm-hmm. And then obviously on the east end and out in Suffolk County, there's still quite a bit of number of larger farms.
Could we talk about the impact that farms have on our economy, especially this time of the year? Do you have any numbers as to what this means to our region?
Well, I know to start with, we were asked to run the Taste New York program. And this is a statewide initiative from the governor's office. It was launched in 2013. And, for example, last year in 2018, there was close to $18 million in sales from New York State products at the different Taste New York stores statewide. And then in Suffolk County, I don't have the exact data, but I know it's the largest agricultural region in the state, which a lot of people don't know that.
Hmm. Now, a number of the listeners today hearing you for the first time live possibly in Connecticut, maybe even in Rhode Island, and they don't know what Taste New York is. What is it?
Yeah, so Taste New York is an initiative from the New York State Department of Ag and Markets, and it's really the main theme is to promote New York State not only farm products, but also beverages and different food products made here in New York State. And, one of the themes that we always look at is kind of regional production. So folks from Connecticut and throughout the region, I'm sure come over to Long Island, enjoy our wines and our different farms and things. So when we're looking at agriculture, we're always looking at it regionally. But from our program side, we are trying to promote more New York products and also educating the customer and the consumer about how important it is to buy local. We hear this theme a lot that people are, into farm to table and are excited about it, but they don't want to, always put their money where their mouth is. So we're a part of the education component where we're really educating the public about how important it is. If you want to drive by and see these vineyards and farms and be a part of it, then you have to support them, keep them in business.
So do a little work, huh?
Yeah, we do a lot of workshops and, just people love to hear the story. So we try to provide the platform where we can tell stories about how startups are launching and things like that.
What is it about this weekend that gets all of us, it seems, out of the house and say, look, we've got to hit a farm this weekend. And you know, along the way, let's pick up a dozen donuts and some cider. And
yeah.
What is it about the weekend, this time of year?
Well, I think to me, it's kind of the shifting of, like I was mentioning, we run the Welcome Center here on Long Island, and we see the tourists kind of switching from going to the beach and to more of the, swimming and things, more to visiting farms and out on the East End and Suffolk, on the North Fork and on the South Fork. And kind of with the temperatures cooling down and fall upon us, seems like folks are more interested in, picking apples and pumpkins and tasting wine and kind of enjoying the farmland that's out east.
And we all seem to find that we have denim shirts and flannel shirts, huh?
There you go.
Hey, how are the farms doing?
It does help that it's harvest time. So I think after all the summer labor on the farms and, the rain and the hot weather, now it's time to pick things. So I know the grape harvest has started and the apple harvest has started, and obviously the pumpkins are out. So I think people are in the mood to finally reap what has been sown.
So, Greg, how are the farms doing nowadays on Long Island? Are they having or experiencing any changes because of climate change? I mean, what are farmers telling you?
Well, what I was out last week on a tour with some farmers and had a meeting at the Cornell Research Lab. And what we heard is that, for one, it's been a great season as far as, in the wine industry especially, it's been one of the best years in a long time for the grapes being ripe and making great wine, and then also, just a bumper crop in all the main areas out there. But we're also hearing, the challenges of being a farmer and the land costs and the labor costs and the cost of taxes, and how important, again, it is that, people are aware of the need to buy local and support local farmers if we want to have agriculture as part of our region. And again, some of it is not just buying at the grocery store, but it's hitting farmers markets and farm stands and some of the retail outlets that are run by these producers, because their margins are higher at the direct retail outlets instead of what they might get wholesale at the grocery stores. So we're always promoting farmers markets and going out east and hitting the farm stands and stopping by the wineries and buying directly from the producers.
So Taste New York is statewide, but does Long Island sell more compared to other parts of the state?
So to give you an idea, so like I said, statewide, we did about $18 million in sales. And on Long Island, our sales were just over $800,000. And over 3 years now, our sales are close to $2.5 million. But what's important to know is that it's also a marketing effort, so it's kind of hard to gauge. You may come into Taste New York and see some of the local producers and then get inspired and go out and visit their farms, or you might see their product in the grocery store and end up buying it. So there's kind of that, magical effect of just kind of, you can't really put a number to it, but you know that you're helping to build a brand and building, recognition, and also educating the customer about how important it is to buy local.
Hmm. Hey, Greg, we did a
program. So we do see that.
Greg, we did a program recently where one of our guests talked about urban farming. And when you were saying before that maybe some of the farms have disappeared in Nassau, people are doing it now in the backyards, it got me thinking about that. I mean, are you seeing that more and more? And when I say urban farming, it's, I'm not just talking about people putting it on rooftops and all the rest, but just backyard stuff.
We see a lot more, folks that may have large backyards, instead of growing grass, they're converting it to gardens and fruit trees, and a lot more interest in preserving and canning at home. And then, one of the themes of Taste New York is that we're always bringing in new vendors. The goal of the program is to rotate in new vendors. So
yeah.
Throughout the 3 years, we now have over 250 vendors. And what we want to do is just continue to provide the opportunity for entrepreneurs to bring their product in. On Long Island, and I'm sure in Connecticut and around the region, we have these incubator kitchens, which are really great. They're geared for small startups. And folks go in and help each other out, help with the labeling and all the different business ideas. And then usually you know, these kitchens are set up so folks could, you know, package their product and get them barcode ready and bring them to market. And then Taste New York steps in, and we make it very easy for these small startups to launch at Taste New York.
That's very cool.
And that's important because we want to have this kind of entry into the market, but then, you know, hopefully they'll grow and move on and head into the retail shelves around the area.
And Greg, we only have 45 seconds left in this segment. While you're saying that, it occurred to me that if there are community gardens, I guess these kitchens would be perfect for them.
Yeah, there's a lot of small vendors that get inspired and they ended up starting small, but then they grow their business and they, you know, end up renting bigger spaces and expanding. And a lot of times at the incubator kitchen, you know, they help each other out. So they look at other business models and other business plans. And it's really a great community effort where they kind of share their knowledge and help these businesses survive, which, you know, it's tricky to start a new business. So it's important that the small vendors all stick together and help each other out.
Absolutely. Greg, I only have 15 seconds left. I have to ask, you going apple picking this weekend?
Absolutely. Taking the family out, tasting a little bit of wine, and picking some pumpkins, and then, of course, having some good food along the way.
What's your favorite apple?
I love the Cornell Empire. Cornell developed a bunch of different varieties, and Empire is one of them, so that's probably one of my favorites. But anything local grown here on Long Island or in the region definitely can taste the difference.
Go Big Red, huh? Greg Sandor.
There you go.
Executive Director of the Cornell Cooperative Extension, Nassau County. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
Be well. Do you remember the movie Good Will Hunting? Do you remember when Matt Damon asks the preppy kid, "Do you like apples?" And then he says, "I got the girl's phone number. How do you like them apples?" Well, we like apples just fine, too, especially this weekend. I think many of you do, too. We're going to spend a few minutes now with John Lyman. John is the Executive Vice President of Lyman Orchards. John, how are you today, sir?
Good, Ron. How are you doing?
I'm great. Ed Harbs is also joining us. Ed owns Harbs Family Farm in Matatuck. Hi, Ed. How are you today?
Hi, I'm doing real well also.
Fantastic. And finally, Dan Beardsley is with us. Dan owns Beardsley Cider Mill and Orchard in Shelton, Connecticut. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for having me on, Ron.
John, I'm going to start with you because I know that Lyman is relatively new to the biz. You've only been around since 1741. You're the young kids. You're the youngins on the block. How's the apple crop this year?
Phenomenal. It's a beautiful crop. It's full. The apples have sized well, and then we had a lot of sun during the season, so the flavor is just outstanding. And it's been one of those years where, you know, you remember how good it is.
John, when you say the flavors are good this year, does that mean across the board for all the different varieties?
Yeah. I mean, apples, what they love during the growing season is lots of sun, obviously adequate rain, but not excessive rain. And, in timing is always important. So, you know, where you don't have, you have nice sunny days and then cool nights and hopefully some rain at night. And for the most part, that's the kind of fall we've had, which has been very special.
Ed, what's the situation like in Matatuck?
Well, about the same. We're not that far as the crow flies. We're probably less than 100 miles from one another. We're on the other side of the Long Island Sound, and we've had very similar weather. It's been a beautiful August and September, and now into October, so it's the type of seasons that apples really love.
And Dan, I'm guessing it's the same for you in Shelton?
Yeah, Ron, we had fantastic weather, especially during pollination time for our apples. So everything got pollinated really well. And as John said, there was adequate rain, lots of good sun, and the apples are just one of our best crops ever. So we're really excited for this season.
Hmm. Ed, you're over on the North Fork. Is this weekend the busiest one of the year for you?
Yes, it sure is.
How many people?
Columbus Day weekend is typically the busiest one of the year. It's a three-day weekend for everyone. And between the Saturday, Sunday, and a Monday, a lot of people choose to make this their weekend for fall activities. You pick pumpkins, you pick apples, just enjoying the harvest time in a general in a way that's relative to their own family. So it's a It's a busy and beautiful time of year.
How many people are you anticipating will come by your farm?
Maybe 5,000 or so.
Nice number.
Yes. Yeah, sure is. We have a good weather forecast, and that's always a big plus. Sometimes we don't have the greatest weather to work with on a weekend like this, but this weekend is supposed to be a good one.
Dan, what is it about this weekend that makes a lot of us want to get out of the house and pretend that we're a farmer, or at least a picker for a few hours? What is it?
Well, I think it's really the time of year. You know, it's autumn. The weather is starting to change and get cooler. When that happens, I think a lot of folks just start thinking about apples and in the fall time crops that they like to come out and help us pick. And we're just really fortunate that this weekend the weather is looking great for all 3 days. And we're hoping to have a lot of folks come out and help us pick our crops.
John, I'm going to go kind of around the horn with this question because, I need to give a little context here, a little bit of background, because I was recently driving in Pennsylvania. Now, this is going back probably a month or so ago, and I stopped at a farm stand to buy some apples. And the owner told me that the apples, now this is all the way down by the Maryland border, she told me that her apples came in much earlier this year, down there at least, and for some varieties, not all, she thought there was a change in quality, which she felt was caused by climate change. And so my question is, are you seeing anything like that, any changes at all that are affecting your crops?
I think, you know, climate change, I mean, the weather, the climate is always changing, so... I'm probably in the camp that I don't necessarily see it as a result necessarily of what man is doing, whatever. I think it's a function of just the natural, the way that it goes through cycles. So there's definitely cycles. You can go through wet cycles, dry cycles, cooler cycles, warmer cycles. You know, and we keep pretty good weather records going all the way back 40 years. That I've been taking them, and you see some years and kind of strings of years where you see that those patterns. So I can't specifically say that, you know, it's been a major change from what we've seen in the past. I think, again, we go through similar years, and but I will say that, you know, climate is always changing. They always say in New England, just if you don't like the weather, wait. Mm. Wait a moment, because it does always change. So, but no, I think, you know, depending on the region of the country, they get in certain patterns. And, you know, in our case where we had beautiful weather, another part of the country, they may be in a zone where they get a lot of rain, don't get so much sunshine, that kind of thing. And that's not abnormal. That happens each season.
Ed, how about on the North Fork? Are you seeing any effects from climate change?
No, I would say with us here, it's more a question of degree of precipitation. Real wet years usually impact crop qualities. Real dry years are okay for us because we have the ability to irrigate everything. We have a real good water supply in the aquifers of Long Island. So to us, it's more of a question of how much precipitation we have. Too much can be a problem. Too little is okay because we can supplement with irrigation.
Dan, I know that you're not, geographically speaking, not too far from Lyman. So are you seeing anything different nowadays for climate change, or do you anticipate any differences in the future?
Well, Ron, I haven't really noticed any major changes from climate change on our farm here. As John mentioned, the weather patterns are cyclical and they are geographically different. But the only thing that I may have noticed is that in the spring, we stay a little bit colder, maybe a week or two longer than we used to in the last couple of years. But again, that's happened before as well. So not really any noticeable climate change that's been affecting us here.
Dan, are you seeing more people nowadays concerned with whether or not pesticides are used, or are more people looking for organic products?
We have a lot of folks that ask us, you know, if our farm is organic. We are not an organic farm here, but we have seen a lot more interest in it. What we do is an integrated pest management system, which I'm sure the other farmers understand. It's just a way of using less pesticides and only using specific ones that are required when you meet a certain threshold from pest pressure. It seems to be the best way to farm for apples in this part of the state for us.
Ed, what's your feelings about organic farming?
Well, we also use sustainable methods such as the integrated pest management that you just alluded to. That way, it kind of is, in some ways, is the best of both worlds. It minimizes pesticide use, but still prevents catastrophic problems like mildew or a mold or something that might take out a crop for the season. I've had some neighbors here that have had vineyards, and some of them experiment with biodynamic and organic methods, and unfortunately the results have been pretty inconsistent. Every once in a while they'll lose a large portion of their crop as a result, which is very financially injurious. So I think the integrated pest management that my colleague alluded to and the sustainable methods are probably the most prudent course for us here.
John Lyman, your thoughts, please.
Yeah, we practice integrated pest management. We actually have been involved now for close to 20 years in a program. It's a third-party certified advanced IPM program. It's called Eco Apples, and it's Eco Peach. And so we have standards that essentially don't allow certain pesticides. Others are allowed, but it's also based on the scouting, and it's a sustainable approach. Philosophy of integrated pest management and advanced integrated pest management is very similar to the philosophy of organic growers, where you're working with the environment within the orchards, trying to minimize your inputs, maximize whatever natural functions are taking place. And the difference is the allowance of synthetic pesticides versus organic pesticides. But the philosophies are very similar. And again, we've been eco-certified apple and peach growers for close to 20 years.
John, what's the biggest problem in running a farm, especially a farm of your size?
Well, I mean, some things are within our control and some things are without. I mean, weather is obviously probably the biggest factor in whether you have a successful season or not. And, of course, you don't control that. Farming is very labor-intensive, so labor can be one of the biggest challenges we face. Getting reliable labor, we're a seasonal business, and so finding reliable labor every year is always a challenge. And then you add to that the increasing cost of labor, and that makes it very difficult, especially when you're in a market where price appreciation is, you know, it's very difficult. And so you have these added costs, and you just have to find a way to keep making improvements in your operations so you can still grow profitably and provide the product and service that your customer expects.
Mm. Ed Harbs, what gives you sleepless nights? What is anything?
Crop you pick. We open up Labor Day weekend with Honeycrisp apples, and each weekend, the Saturday and Sunday, between the weekends in September and October, we generate 80% of our income for the year. So what causes me a sleepless night or anxiety is bad weather on a Saturday or Sunday. So fortunately, October is statistically the driest month of the year. So fortunately, that's in our favor. But when that occurs, you know, whether it rains on a Saturday or a Monday or a Wednesday, can make all a great difference to our bottom line. So we've just been very blessed this year that it's been low precipitation on weekends so far, and even this weekend's looking like a good one. So if the good Lord continues to bless us with good weather on weekends, that's an answer to prayer for us.
Dan, how about for the Beardsleys?
Well, I'd like to mirror what John and Ed said. We need good weather for pollination and for during our growing season, but we also need to have that good weather for our pick-your-own operations on weekends in September and October. And this year we seem to be having some more trouble with employees. We typically hire younger employees to work out in our orchards with us. We hire a lot of local high school and college kids. And there just doesn't seem to be as many kids available, and those that are don't always show up. So we're having some trouble covering all of our employee needs.
Do you mean just the pool has been reduced in size, or they're just not interested in working on the farm anymore?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. A lot of the kids have other jobs because, you know, I think because the economy is doing well, there's a lot of jobs available. So the pool has shrunk a little bit. And those that are working just seem to demand from me their schedule rather than work around my schedule. So it's just been a challenge, but we're getting through. And the kids that we do have working here, I have to say, are really, really good kids.
I apologize for laughing, but I was talking with someone who's a little bit younger recently, and they were complaining about the fact that their boss wanted them to come in at a certain hour. And I'm looking at them and I'm going, you're an employee. you show up to work when they tell you to show up to work. John, it sounds like you were saying the same thing just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's, it definitely some new challenges with the term millennial gets thrown around a lot in terms of, the next generation. But I think, there's pluses and minuses to every generation, and you just have to find a way to work through it and motivate your employees. But we've been similar to Dan. We've been blessed with the workers we do have. They're really good. They're really dedicated. And it's just sometimes in the peak season, getting enough help at the time you need it can be a little bit of a challenge. You know, we do have the pick your own. We have the retail. We have pie production. We have our packing. So there's a lot of activities going on where we do hire a lot of people. And peak season, we're over 200 employees. And then during our off season, we have, around 40 or 50 full-time or regular employees. So you can see the big swing just in that. And that seasonality is really confined more to 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, 3 or 4 months within a year. So very, very drastic changes.
Dan Beardsley, I've got about a minute and a half left in this segment over the next few weekends because the weather does look nice. I looked at the long-range forecast. It looks like it's going to be in the 60s for the next month or so. If people come out on the weekends, what should they be bringing? What's the best thing to do in terms of apple picking, pumpkin picking, squash picking? How should they dress? What should they bring?
Well, folks just need to remember that this is an active farm, so the ground is going to be a little bit uneven in places. If we have some rain, there may be some, muddy spots and things. So you want to wear footwear that's going to give you some traction in terrain like that. A lot of times when you're outside for a little while, you can get cold, so you want to dress in layers. And if it looks like it could rain, you might want to just bring along a raincoat. Other than that, just come on out and enjoy a beautiful day in the orchard and pick some fruit and have some fun.
So, Ed, it sounds like Dan is saying, whatever you do, don't show up in your Sunday best.
Well, yes, that's always
high heeled shoes are not recommended.
Every once in a while, somebody would show up on the farm with high heel shoes, and really, really expensive shoes, and sometimes I'd get annoyed when their fancy shoes get muddy or dirty. But for the most of our customers dress appropriate for the seasons and the times and have a real good time.
Ed Harbs Sr. is the owner of Harbs Family Farm in Matatuck, Long Island. Dan Beardsley is the owner of Beardsley Cider Mill and Orchard in Shelton, Connecticut. And John Lyman is the executive vice president of Lyman Orchards in Middlefield, Connecticut. John, Ed, Dan, thank you. I appreciate your time. I know it's the busy weekend for you, and I'm grateful for you taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, Ron.
Yep. Take care.
Thanks for having us on, Ron.
Thank you.
Presenting us to the public.
Bye-bye now. Now, we had a show about farmers markets a few weeks back, and on it we had a segment about bees, and that segment created quite the buzz. So we thought we should talk about it a little bit more, even though I know some thought I was droning on, but, you know, don't worry about it. Just be happy. I'm going to introduce you to our next guest. Debbie Klugers is the owner of Bonac Bees in East Hampton. Debbie, it's good to speak with you again. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We are also going to welcome in Mary Waltz, the owner of Bees Needs in Sag Harbor. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Ron. Thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. And also Vincent Kay, who is the owner of Swords into Plowshares Honey out of New Haven. Hi, Vincent. How are you?
Very good, sir. Thank you for having me.
Debbie, I have to start with you because it was our segment with you that prompted so many emails and people to call in because, you know what, they were saying we didn't realize how important bees were to what takes place in our region. Again, for those who may be hearing you for the first time, what do bees offer all of us? What do they mean to us?
Well, the intrinsic value of the honeybee, just for being itself, is the most important. But what they do provide us, not only food due to the pollination efforts of the honeybees, but they also give us all kinds of different medicines from inside of the hive. We've got honey, beeswax, royal jelly, pollen, propolis, even hive air has been becoming a new tool in the medicine chest in order to help people heal. They also help feed our wildlife and give our wildlife homes due to the pollination of the plants. And they also are responsible for the plant reproduction. So they benefit every living thing on the planet, honestly. They're probably one of the most important species on the planet and just leave the world a better place.
Vincent Kay is the owner of Swords into Plowshares Honey, based out of New Haven. Vincent, I know some people are going to be listening to the program and they're saying, New Haven? Bees? Bees in the city? Tell us about it.
Well, we do keep some bees in the city, and they do very well. A lot of the honey from Connecticut doesn't necessarily come from farms. It comes from the forests and woods and swamps and meadows that we have. A lot of linden trees in New Haven produce a very, very profuse and delicious honey mid-June to late June, and we get thousands of pounds of honey. All of the honey that we produce comes back and is processed here, spun out of the combs and filtered through cheesecloth and then bottled. But we have hives from Westbrook, Connecticut, all the way to Oxford, so probably in about 15 different towns.
How many hives do you have?
We have, I'd say this year, close to about 500.
When did you get into the business?
I got into the business years ago. This is our 35th year. And it began as a hobby, a backyard hobby with one or two hives. And I just fell in love with it and with the bees. And just sort of the sorcerer's apprentice became exponentially larger and larger. And then I said, well, let me just try it as a business. And we went for it, and we haven't stopped since.
I have to ask before I bring Mary into the conversation. When you started this, did some of your neighbors kind of look at you cross-eyed?
No. Well, you know, we've always had bees here in the backyard, right in New Haven. But there's a way of keeping bees where most of the time you don't even know they're there. Sometimes it's on a rooftop. Sometimes it's behind a fence or a shrub fence, a green fence of sorts. And the bees go up. They don't go across people's yards. And honeybees are really not interested in causing any kind of fuss. Sometimes they'll go to a neighbor's bird bath or something looking for water in the hot part of the summer. But in general, you just don't even know they're there. You know, it's just a great symbiotic relationship.
Mary Waltz is the owner of Bees Needs in Sag Harbor. Mary, thanks for being patient. When did you start becoming a beekeeper?
Well, I was first introduced to honeybees in 2002 when I was managing a biodynamic garden at a research and training center at, called the Pfeiffer Center in Rockland County, New York. And I learned of the difficulties the honeybees had encountered in the late 80s when we lost over half of our honeybee colonies in the United States. This was part of a worldwide phenomenon with the inadvertent introduction of two parasitic mites. It began in Europe in the 70s, but the mites got to the U.S. in the 80s, and our bee population was cut in half. So in learning about the trials and tribulations they were up against and also beginning to work with them, I decided to devote all of my energy towards their well-being. So I've been doing it ever since. And in 2003, I was offered a job on the east end of Long Island working for the Hamptons Hunting Company. And I only had just over a year's experience and found myself managing 100 colonies more or less alone. So the bees were excellent teachers, and we've worked together ever since.
Mary, how is the bee population nowadays?
Well, it's suffering. It continues. The mites have continued to be a problem, but it was becoming more or less manageable with annual losses between 10 and 15% until 2007, coincidentally the same year I started my business, when a phenomenon called colony collapse disorder emerged, and we lost a third of our honeybee colonies at that point, and have continued to do so ever since, with last year losses mounting to 40%, the highest since they've been recorded annually. So to put that in context, if we were losing a third of our cattle population, you know, we've had hoof and mouth scares or bird flu scares, losing our poultry population, if we were losing that amount of any other livestock annually, I think we would be hearing a lot more about it. But this has been ongoing with the honeybee, and it can't continue much longer.
Debbie, what are your thoughts on this?
In America, they're not doing well. Globally, the bees are doing pretty darn good. We've got over 80 million honeybee colonies across the world, and millions more uncounted in Africa. Wild honeybee colonies are largely uncounted. So the bees are doing okay globally. It's here in America where we are suffering, and last year was the worst ever recorded winter loss, a little bit over 40% nationwide. Now, keep in mind that we had about 6 million honeybee colonies back in the 1950s. And a lot of that increase was a little bit due to the war effort prior that we needed the beeswax. So the bee population, maybe in the 30s or 40s, is about 3 million, increased to about 6 in a short period of time. And since the 50s, we have had a steep decline. And the colony collapse was just the icing on the cake that maybe got people to notice, you know, that things were not quite right. So it's really a North American or an American problem, I feel, and we need to do some, you know, hard thinking about how we're going to go forward to have a sustainable honeybee population in order to have a secure food supply. Most of our bees in America go over to the almonds in February. So we've got about 2 million honeybee colonies all in one place. And those honeybees are the ones that are the ones crossing our country throughout the year to pollinate, you know, most of our commercial crops. So we are at a point that it's kind of snooze or lose. We're gonna have a problem if we don't figure out what's hurting the bees. And, you know, I'm going to have to do a little plug here. In New York, I've just got some legislation passed or on the way to be passing. It was just introduced last Friday in the Senate to save honeybee swarms and colonies and structures where they end up, you know, in an unwanted place. And right now it's legal to exterminate them. And when this law passes, it will become illegal for anybody to exterminate them under certain circumstances. It will be okay. But that's a real solid something that we can do, that we can actually look at and say, look, we saved, you know, 1,000 honeybee colonies in New York State from extermination. You know, so things like that, really solid things that people can do to help. Big problem for the bees is nutrition. So the other guest spoke about the linden trees. Excellent source. If you plant one linden tree, one nice large tree will give as much flowers to the honeybees as a whole acre of wildflowers. So, you know, planting trees and bushes, privet is another excellent source for the honeybees. So things like that that people can really do, give them food and support your beekeepers. You know, come to our talks, buy our honey, and, you know, let us know that you're watching us and, you know, that you appreciate what we're doing, and we appreciate that feedback, because being a beekeeper is really hard work, and it's sad when, you know, a lot of your colonies are dying due to nothing that you've done. You do the best you can, and in April you come across a whole colony pouring out of the hive after have been sprayed by, you know, some sort of a residential pesticide.
Sure.
Beautification, or someone's idea of beautiful, property. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that every single person can do and should do, especially here in America. Support bee research. You know, send money to these young scientists that are, you know, breaking out with new new science to help us save the bees.
Because, let me bring,
you know,
Vincent.
Again,
let me bring Vincent in here.
Again, the honeybees are only important if you eat food or if you know someone that eats food. So other than that, you know.
Let me bring Vincent in here, because I'm running short on time. Vincent, I just, after our last program, I got an email from someone saying, look, if you revisit this topic again, can you just ask, and they said it's a basic question, why is it that different honeys have different flavors, different smells? And they said, please have someone explain that. Can you explain that for us, please?
Sure. Different flavors of honey. It's quite simple. They actually have different colors and flavors, but they come from the different flowers that the bees are gathering from. The bees gather the nectar, they bring it back, and they put it in the comb from a particular flower source that may be blooming quite heavily at that moment or that time, that week. And then you have like a micro crop that's stored away in the comb, and the bees fan their wings over it to evaporate the moisture and reduce it, and then they seal it over with beeswax. And so there you have, you know, one particular nectar or honey from one particular bloom. So Japanese knotweed has a beautiful red color, the color of red wine. White clover is quite light. It's almost a yellow amber, but it's kind of a, you know, it's a yellowish white. And you have sweet pepper bush or clethra, which is almost a clear honey. It's a delicious honey that comes from a flower mostly in the swamps of eastern Connecticut. It's a conundrum as to how your previous speakers there have been talking about the health of the honeybees. And if I may, I would just like to say that we have noticed, because we keep bees in so many different locations in towns, that some of the towns that are more aggressive in things like spraying for ticks and mosquitoes are affecting the honeybees in a very negative way. And I know that public health is a big issue here, but also are the honeybees. And so I think in general, the American people have to decide whether or not they have a picture of what the American lawn should look like. And the American lawn is a very toxic place. It has chemicals and fertilizers and herbicides and pesticides all in one big application sometimes. And this also affects the honeybees. And I think we need to revisit the general concept of what the American lawn should look like. My lawn has clover, it has dandelions, it has a variety of things, and it's lovely. There's earthworms, there's butterflies, there's honeybees, there's all sorts of birds. And a lot of times, even the state of Connecticut here, will has a program, and they've been beating the drum about invasive species of plants. And so many of these invasive species, like knotweed and autumn olive and other things, are really very, very important to the health of honeybees and other pollinators and also birds. And so the fruit left behind on some of these bushes and plants in the form of berries sustain, you know, migratory birds coming through. And often you see, companies either mowing flowers when they shouldn't be or the state has been aggressively spraying to try to eradicate these things. And I think it's a misapplied kind of logic about everything in this country is invasive. I mean, but it's what we have. And unless you have a plan to replant after you've eradicated, say, an acre of Japanese knotweed with something of equal benefit or value, then I really don't think you have a right to poison the earth. And that's exactly what's being done.
Mary, I only have 45 seconds to a minute left, so I'm going to give you the last word here. Give us your final thoughts. And I have one other question for you. If I go and I buy some of your honey, how long does it last for?
Well, honey is the only natural food that never spoils. So it was dug up in the pyramid from the pyramids, and it was still okay. So it lasts. It's not going. It would last a lot longer if you don't eat it as quickly as you probably will.
That's not going to happen in my household.
but I have your listening audience is probably familiar with Michael Pollan and his three rules from Omnivore's Dilemma: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. I have three rules for helping the bees. Don't spray, plant trees and shrubs, and eat honey.
Mary Waltz, owner of Bees Needs in Sag Harbor. Vincent Kay, owner of Swords into Plowshares Honey out of New Haven. And Debbie Klugers, the owner of Bonac Bees in East Hampton. Debbie, Vincent, Mary, thank you. I appreciate your time. It was a wonderful discussion. Please come back.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you.
That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers, Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.